Organizations had sued the city of Milwaukee, alleging the arranged parade routes violated free speech. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba ante mí.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Lisa Detmer, and I'm your co-host, along with filmmaker and artist and environmental activist Kim Ono. And we are talking to three queer ecology activists who are courageously fighting the climate crisis in the state of Florida. These inspiring and creative activists' struggles and fight is represented in the new film Can't Stop Change, Clear Climate Stories from the Florida Frontlines, which is now available to see online at Kinema for the month of July. This documentary, Can't Stop Change, weaves together interviews with 14 trans, queer, and two-spirit collaborators across Florida, bravely fighting for change in one of the most anti-queer states and a state that has been battered by natural and political storms, climate gentrification, and displacement. These activists target the disproportionate effect natural disasters have on oppressed communities based on race, class, and gender and sexuality, and link the environmental disasters with the political disasters of anti-abortion and anti-trans bills, permitless concealed carry laws, and white patriarchal corporate power that militarizes the police. Unlike many mainstream environmental groups, these queer ecology activists recognize that we need deep structural change that challenges cis, heterosexual, white capitalist patriarchy and doesn't just treat symptoms. In the face of all this devastation, these queer and trans ecology activists in Florida are courageously imagining a better future and tackling the issues head-on through mutual aid, building queer communities, and standing up to corporations and bad politics. In this stirring documentary, they follow these inspirational activists as they tour the state, meet with mutual aid providers to uncover the challenges of each area, and learn about the passionate work being done to combat them. We talk to Vanessa Raddatz, the co-director of Can't Stop Change, who is also a queer climate justice queer ecology activist in the Southeast and the Bay Area. And we talked to Florida native Barbara Perez, who is a PhD student at Florida Atlantic University, where she's doing her dissertation on climate gentrification. And lastly, we talked to Rebecca Wood, who is an environmental educator and Miami resident, who is currently involved in local climate activism and community disaster preparedness. Welcome, Vanessa, Rebecca, and Barbara to Women's Magazine. Vanessa, Kim and I really loved this film, Can't Stop Change, Queer Climate Stories from the Florida Frontlines. And for me, in particular, what I appreciated was the really radical voices presented and the imaginative way it was filmed. Why did you want to make this film, and how did you come to get involved in this film about queer activism around climate chaos in Florida?
Well, thank you so much for having us on the show, just to start. And I want to just start by saying that, you know, this is a story that wanted to be told and that many people are telling in many different ways. And each of us in our five-person co-director team was pulled into the orbit of this story in different ways. I wanted to be part of this film because the frequency and severity of extreme weather is accelerating really rapidly. And even though queer and trans people are part of every community that's on the front lines of harm, the mainstream LGBTQ plus movement, you know, is increasingly siloed in very, very one-dimensional, very narrow legislative battles. And, you know, I wanted to be part of a kind of community-based story that goes to the roots, that centers structures like colonialism and racial capitalism as drivers to the harm to bodies and lands, And with that understanding allows us to, in fact, insists that we need bold and proactive organizing that's deeply embedded in, rooted in our own ecologies. So I've been thinking about this nexus, this constellation of ideas, for nearly a decade now, with enormous influence actually from the Bay Area and the Oakland-based, particularly Oakland-based organization, Movement Generation, Justice and Ecology Project. They've been an enormous set of teachers, influences for me. So my first film, Fire and Flood, which I'm still working on, that started with my lived experiences of being in the Tubbs Fire here in California in the fall of 2017, which at that point in time, right, was the worst fires we've ever had in California's history. Every year since then has been the worst fires in California's history. But through that, I also built relationships with queer folks in Puerto Rico that were dealing with the near simultaneous disaster of Hurricane Maria, happened just about the same time as the Tubbs Fire, but going through very different experiences because of their relationship to the U.S. So it was through that project that I met two of the other co-directors for Can't Stop Change, Natalia Vieran Quiñones in Puerto Rico, and Yaro Koning, who at that point was living in Florida. So the idea for Can't Stop Change came to us when Natalia and I were invited to give a talk about fire and flood at Florida Atlantic University. Barbara was also a student, but at that time, Yaro was a graduate student there. Yaro then introduced us to Jimmy and Robin, who had organized mutual aid efforts in the wake of Hurricane Ian. And through those conversations, you know, this story just started to reveal itself to us and kind of grabbed us into its orbit. And the initial idea, we were just going to do a rapid doc. We raised money very quickly to do a one-week production trip where we met 11 amazing activists, organizers, ecologists, artists across the state. Then through conversations, dialogue with these collaborators, we then went back for another three more interviews. Rebecca was really insistent that there was someone who we needed to interview, Valencia Gunder, and you were right. Right. So we listened, we had these conversations, and we're like, we need to go back. So just a little more than a year later, here we are with a feature length documentary, not what we were intending, but I think what needed to happen. And in addition to festivals, it's now available to watch on demand on Kinema for the full month of July to raise funds for disaster preparedness, response, and mutual aid needs in Florida. So that was always the dream. That was always the intention. This project was intended to be an organizing tool. And I'm really excited that about a year later, that's what we're doing.
Vanessa, your film structure reflected the radicalness of the subject in this film. For instance, you featured many different radical queer and trans activist voices, which we couldn't fit in the show. So I'm sure there's people you left out. But many documentary filmmakers have experienced funders' preference for single character films, like it's driven down our throats type of thing, and which pushes the narrative away from the idea of an ensemble or group of people or movement of people creating change towards Hollywood or Sundance influenced narratives, a single hero or an individualistic approach. Was there any pressure to collapse the story into a single hero? And then was it your intention to always show a community working together?
I love this question, and it's one of the things I love talking with you as another fellow filmmaker, that you can pay attention to those things. And I think it's really important to center the fact that we're community organizers who made a film, not filmmakers who are trying to organize. That makes a difference on so many levels. You mentioned funding a lot, because funding drives so much of what we do. But our funders are social movement funders. Really grateful to all the different kinds of emergent and emergency urgent funds that are out there now within social justice movements, including Third Wave Fund. I'm going to shout them out because they believed in us in a time that was really needed. And so almost all of us are first-time filmmakers. None of us were formally trained in film school, so we haven't necessarily been told, you know, what the rules are. So, you know, we're breaking them by instinct. I think my main training came from oral histories, where the emphasis really is on more voices. Like, how do you tell a multivocal story in order to capture the multidimensionality of an issue? You know, this is a as one of the programmers for Frameline told me, the reason that it was picked is that it's a trans story that isn't just about trans issues. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, it's a multidimensional story that looks at the many different ways that Florida legislature is harming different kinds of people for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And then investigating and asking more questions about, well, what's really going on underneath all of that. Mm-hmm. And how do we build futures where it's not just queer people fighting for queer lives, but like we're all recognizing our shared needs as living creatures on a planet going through immense change. The hope is to build more effective and integrated coalitions among people who may not often see their work as being related.
That's great. Thank you. Barbara, I love how in the film, how you connect the issues of climate, class, race, and gender and sexuality, all being affected by the heteronormative white supremacist capitalism. We're all kind of grappling with that. And you mentioned how the film is important not to just fix symptoms, but to address the root of the problem. Why is it important to connect the dots between climate activism and queer activism and queer ecology?
And what is queer ecology?
I really love this question. My dissertation deals in this topic a lot. So this is something that I really enjoy talking about, and it's incredibly complex. But essentially, we constantly have to be smart and critical by using an intersectional lens to ask, okay, what systems of oppression are implicated here? How do they connect? And who benefits from this ultimately? And in addition to that, how can we form coalitions with other people or with other groups to fight this? How is my liberation tied to yours? And I think that my work and this documentary really highlights how systems of oppression have been connected. I usually like to give resources that folks can turn to read in case they want to do more research. But a really great book that I highlight in my dissertation that talks about this is A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things by Raj Patel and Jason Moore. But they essentially discuss how capitalism and the drive for profit and the constant need of capitalism to expand and the economy to expand leads to the exploitation of natural resources and environmental degradation. So as I said, because capitalism constantly needs to expand and we're always looking for new frontiers, or rather capitalist powers are looking for new frontiers, they have developed systems of control or systems of oppression in order to justify that expansion and the exploitation that the expansion requires. So one of the examples that I highlight in my work and that this book also highlights is the era of colonialism. So the Americas were a new frontier. And in order to be able to exploit the Americas, right, to take the land and all the resources there, there needed to be a justification for social control, a justification to take the lands away from indigenous people and the resources away from indigenous people, and also a way to have cheap or free labor. So racism was devised as a tool there, a form of social control, which allowed there to be a hierarchy of exploitation, but also justification for that exploitation. So through that example, we can see how not only have people of color and particularly indigenous people been disparaged, but nature as well. And this has occurred through a link between nature and marginalized people, in this case, people of color. So most people that have been cast into nature or associated with nature throughout history, such as people of color, such as women, for example, low-income or low-wealth people and communities, they have all been disparaged through the justification that nature is an object. Nature is passive and something to be exploited, and therefore these people that are associated with nature are allowed to be exploited as well. So it's really interesting because not only is this dichotomy between nature and society, not only does that allow for the exploitation, but by creating, you know, a case where exploitation is needed due to capitalism, but it also actually justifies, so provides some kind of logic to justify the oppression as well. And queer ecology, it's so important because it challenges these understandings that we take for granted as part of the status quo. So these links between nature and groups of people, or in the case of queer people have usually not been cast into nature, but actually completely outside of it. So outside of the status quo as quote unquote unnatural. Queer ecology is something that challenges this heteronormative understanding of nature and ecology. And this early understanding, this is something that I also talk about in my work, but it actually stems from early naturalists, zoologists, biologists, and behaviorists who all allowed their own personal biases, right? So the understandings of the time to inform their work. But because they were operating within this facade of objectivity, that they were objective and that they didn't actually allow these beliefs to influence their work, they were able to put forth what people thought was a completely objective science, which we still very much allow to structure our world today. So they created this mold, and we continue to try to fit the world now into this mold, or rather ruling powers try to continue to fit the world into that mold that they created under this veneer that mold is actually natural when it is not. So what queer ecology does is it uses something that in feminism we call strong objectivity, which is actually just talking about how biases do influence our work. And in a way, they should, because we should allow our values and the values that we have in society to influence our work, but talk about it in a very transparent way rather than operate under this false understanding that it's objective and that we don't actually let our values influence our work. But essentially, it challenges these understandings and points out how the world is so much more complex and interesting than what we thought it was.
And Barbara, you talk about that a little bit in the film when you talk about working with the feminist professor Jane Caputi, who teaches at Florida Atlantic University, and the influence of ecofeminism on your concept of queer activism. What are those, you mentioned a little bit, what are some of those feminist influences and how are they important to queer ecology? Oh, and I also want to note that traditionally women are seen as part of Mother Nature. So that's an interesting comparison with queers who are seen as not part of nature. But anyhow, if you could just talk a little bit about the relationship there.
Just like you said, historically, women were a group that were cast into nature, as I mentioned previously, and that allowed for their exploitation. So a lot of different ecofeminists have written about this. Carol Merchant was one of the earlier ecofeminists to write about this, but essentially, there was a capitalist need to exploit nature with the rise of capitalism, because previously nature was really venerated, right? So something like mining would have been seen as a violence to Mother Nature Earth, because it was going in and taking away resources from Mother Nature Earth in a very violent way. Because there was this need to justify violent acts like that exploited nature, nature began to become constructed as passive and objectified. And because historically, and of course, I'm talking about this within a Western worldview, a European Western worldview. And I want to point that out because this wasn't the case for all other cultures. But the reason why I'm highlighting this is because of colonialism. So this is the hegemonic world order today that we have because of colonialism. But because women in this worldview were previously associated with nature and became more and more associated with nature, and there was that link, as nature became objectified and constructed as passive, and as it became exploited, women were as well. And this presented another capitalist opportunity, which was an opportunity for free labor. So as women became exploited, they started to realize, okay, well, we don't have to pay women. We can just take advantage of their free labor, which of course benefited particularly white men in positions of power. So ecofeminism highlights this link, but also other links intersectionally. So as I talked about before with colonialism, with racism, the links between heterosexism. So there are a lot of other links that ecofeminism talks about as well. And some of the influences that I've highlighted in my work in particular are the work of Maria Mize and Vandana Shiva. So they have a really great book called Ecofeminism, which goes over a lot of these histories and integrates a lot of these points of view, and particularly emphasizes the voices and lived experiences actually of women of color in the global South, and of queer people, and also disabled people. So these are some of the more vulnerable populations globally. And I think that ecofeminism tries to highlight these voices because we can kind of learn and be more transparent about these systems of power and learn how to dismantle them when we turn to those voices and those experiences. And in terms of the links between ecofeminism and queer ecology, I think one of the links that are most important are the methodologies and methods that are used. So a lot of the theories are the same or kind of borrow from each other, but in particular, queer methodology, how it challenges those heteronormative standards. That's something that intersectional feminist methodology and methods definitely borrows from. And there's also links to indigenous decolonial methodologies, which all help to complicate the world and to emphasize the interconnectedness and reliance that we have on each other.
Thank you. And before I bring you in, Rebecca, I want to hear about your activism. But I want to just do an ID to let people know, if you're just tuning in, this is KPFA Radio's Women's Magazine, and I'm Lisa Detmer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kim Ano, and we're talking to one of the co-directors of the powerful, inspiring new film, Can't Stop Change, Queer Climate Stories from the Florida Frontlines, which is in film festivals right now and is going to be streaming for a month in when, Vanessa?
It's streaming right now.
For
the full month of July.
And we're also talking to Rebecca Wood and Barbara Perez, two of the group of queer activists and scholars featured in this wonderful new film, Can't Stop Change. So, Rebecca, I wanted to bring you in. Your activism looks amazing. I'd like to know more about it, but I'd also wanted to set the stage for people that the film does, which is how the capitalist history of Florida has exacerbated the climate changes in Florida, including the draining of the swamplands for development early on, which I didn't know about. Maybe you can explain some of the climate issues in Florida that are unique to Florida. I think people know about some of the hurricanes and the rising seawater, but it's complicated there, and also that you have this right-wing government that's not probably addressing these issues. So can you talk about some of what's going on in Florida and why climate activism is so imperative there?
Yeah, for sure. I think that everywhere in the world, we are actively currently susceptible to real-time climate impacts. As Vanessa was saying, the fires in California are getting worse every year, or they say that every year, this is the worst one. And it's because it's truth. It is the worst one every year. And we are also experiencing real-time climate impacts here in South Florida on many, many levels. But there are unique pieces to what we're experiencing here and why. I think that the things that create the climate scenario that we're in Florida right now. And I also want to name that I live in Miami and I know way more about South Florida than other parts of Florida. So Florida is a really big place. But when I'm speaking about Florida, I'm really focused on South Florida. And I want to name that out loud because not everything that's happening in South Florida happens the same in other parts of the state. It's a big place. But I think there's really kind of three different things you can look at to understand where we are right now. There is the actual natural history of Florida, the geologic, hydraulic, ecologic history of Florida. There is the more recent history of development of Florida and how that played out, how it happened, and how it got us to where we are right now. And then there is the political climate as well, which definitely impacts what's happening and what our potential future could look like. So naturally, ecologically, geologically, Florida is a place that's shaped by water. We are a peninsula surrounded on three sides by water, a long peninsula, so it's a lot of water. We had historically, we have we had a huge 60-mile wide, 100-mile long, slow-moving river that ran down the middle of the state, the Everglades. And that was fed by Lake Okeechobee, which is considered to be like the heart of Florida, the second largest lake in the United States that's contained within one state. So it's a lot of water, but not only that, we are on top of water. We sit on top of a series of surficial aquifers, which is where we get our fresh drinking water from. And here in South Florida, in some places, aquifers only 5 feet below the ground. So it's right on top of the water. And I think that's really significant. We, of course, know that all low-lying coastal cities are at really high risk of sea level rise and impacts of climate change in that way. But if you think about the fact that we're so surrounded by water and what sea level rise, I think, is a little bit complicated to understand, because it's not just that the sea is coming up. It's, in our case, a lot of it has to do with the sea coming down into our groundwater and impacting our groundwater supply. But if you think about the impact of climate change on water and the fact that we're so surrounded by water, that really does, to me, increase the scale of what impact there can be. And then we're, of course, in a subtropical place. And that also is, you know, we've always been a subtropical place. That means we've always had a lot of heat and humidity. And as climate change is happening, those things are increasing, and those things are putting us at real risk and increased impact. And those are the things that have kind of been always at play, right? That's like the foundation that we're working with. So that slow moving 60 mile wide, 100 mile long river of grass, the Everglades, is no longer here. It's been fragmented and destroyed in many ways. So we have what we call the Everglades, but it's really just a fragment of what it once was. But what's really crazy to me when I think about Florida is that that slow moving river was here not very long ago. So the major development in Miami only started in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So historically, before that time, almost all of South Florida was wet, swampy land. There was only a small area of dry land that could be built upon. And that was less than 150 years ago. So for me, when I think about a place that less than 150 years ago was almost entirely swamplands, and now if you come to it, it's an extremely built up city, that's a really short amount of time to go through that level of change. And the only way that can happen is in a haphazard, unplanned way. And so when you look into the history of how South Florida was developed, it all hinged on the draining of the swamp. And the draining of the swamp was led by almost exclusively wealthy white men from the north, like wealthy oil tycoons who came down, or railroad folks who came down and saw Florida as a business opportunity. And they made it that. They saw the ways they could sell the land. But in order to sell the land, they had to drain the land. So this haphazard draining happened in a way that was in no way for the people that lived here, and no way for the people that would live here in the future. It happened in a way that would make money for a few people. And so it's created really problematic situations. We took away all of our natural storm mitigation systems. We destroyed massive amounts of ecosystems. All of Miami Beach historically was a mangrove island, which is the number one most effective natural ecosystem for mitigating storms and wave and wind effect. So Miami Beach historically was a mangrove island. It was not a land island. There was not land on Miami Beach. They cut down the mangroves, dredged the bottom of the bay, and put that on top of the mangroves to create what is now Miami Beach. So we went from the most effective storm protection system to a man-made, essentially fill island. Like, it's a natural island, but not really. And so we've taken away all of these storm mitigation systems that existed here for a reason, because historically this is a place that always experienced hurricanes. We've always experienced storms. It is a subtropical hot place, but we took away all of those natural storm mitigations. We drained this swampland in a way that didn't put flood mitigation into the plan. So we didn't change the shape of the land. We just took the water away, which means that the land is always going to want to flood. So as we're experiencing more intense storms, as we're experiencing rising sea level, we have this land that wants to be swampy, and the development didn't happen in a way that would take that into account. Like, we're going to bring a lot of people to live here, but we're going to take away all the natural protections and not build in any real protections. So yeah, so those are really major things at play here. And then the political climate certainly impacts us. Put out the fire.
Spotlight Africa speaks to a different African reality.
I think we need to begin to engage as equals rather than begin to engage as if we are Africa is a territory where people from outside have a right to be able to dictate and give a solution.
It's about understanding contemporary Africa, the continent's current affairs, politics, economics, and the significance of Africa globally. I am Assumpta Oturu. Join us every Saturday at noon here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. That is Spotlight Africa, every Saturday at noon here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
And our countries are colonial structures.
Africa for Africa.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
put out the fire.
Vanessa Raddatz, put Barbara Pettit, and Rebecca Wood, queer activists talking about the film Can't Stop Change, Queer Climate Stories from the Florida Frontlines.
When you have a government that is largely made up of climate deniers, there is real-time impact from that. In Miami-Dade County last year, we almost passed a historic heat ordinance that was a protection for outdoor workers, specifically migrant workers in the fields or agricultural workers in the fields in Homestead. We are experiencing extreme excessive heat here every year. We are having more and more days in the summertime, which our summer is very long here. But in the formal summertime, we're having more and more days of excessive heat where it is dangerous to go outside. That is actually happening. Miami is actually considered one of the second hottest city in the United States, second to Honolulu, because of our high humidity. Even though our temperatures don't get as high as some places like Phoenix, the humidity holds that heat and is way more dangerous to be outside in. And so our agriculture workers are at possibly the highest risk, right? All outdoor workers are at the highest risk of people here. And Miami-Dade County was on the verge of passing a really historic heat ordinance here that was going to build in protections for outdoor workers in these days of increased excessive heat. And then Ron DeSantis passed a bill or a law for the entire state saying that not only Miami-Dade County, but that no county or city, no municipality was allowed to pass heat ordinances. So it's a really explicit, like, it'd be one thing if they were just denying climate change, but it's like actively working against people who are trying to protect each other, right? They are actively creating life-threatening situations. We are in a life-threatening situation because of all of these things, because of climate change, and they are actively keeping it life-threatening. So, yeah.
I have just a quick follow-up. Rebecca, having experienced in Florida, it seems like every full moon they have to reroute the highway because of the water entering into Miami. And then the other thing, this sort of opacity about when sea level rise is going to affect Florida. Like, how does the right-wing government react to this? These issues that are actually just right there. Okay, we've got to reroute the highway. Like what did they say about that? You know, like, do they have a whole narrative about, you know, the building came down, like there's just really dramatic events. And I'm just wondering, what is the spin on that?
I don't have a good answer to that. And I welcome Barbara or anybody else to jump in. I don't think they have a good spin on it. I think that they're kind of like, deflect. And yeah, but Barbara, please jump in.
They really don't have a good spin on it. They just completely ignore it. And we just kind of take it for granted that that's something that happens. And in terms of when sea level rise is going to affect us, it's already affecting us. I mean, I left Miami in June, mid-June, and literally the day that I left for California, it started raining, and it rained straight through the weekend, and all of Fort Lauderdale and a lot of Miami flooded. And the same thing happened last year around this time. We get things like sunny day floods, even where it floods when it's not even raining. And then, of course, when it rains, it floods. So it's already affecting us. And of course, the storm season is getting worse and worse. So this year, NOAA has predicted that it's going to be one of the worst years in a while. They think that there's about an 85% chance that there's going to be more and worse storms this year. And they really just don't address it. The government in Florida doesn't address it. And we all just kind of take it for granted that that's the risk of living there, which is scary because for a lot of people, like I grew up in Miami, so it's scary kind of seeing it get worse and worse every year. As Rebecca had said, every summer it gets hotter and hotter, and there's just nothing that's being done to address it.
Now we want to talk about the experience for queer people in the state of Florida. And in the movie, one of the participants mentions this concept of transgenocide. And I wonder, that's the first time I've heard it capsulized like that. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what is it like for queer people in Florida right now? What is this concept of transgenocide? And also, I see that, you know, people have to organize all the time, and that gets exhausting. And so how do you take care of yourself in midst of this onslaught that you guys are experiencing? Maybe Vanessa, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. The film really centers the way that the state is harming trans people, not necessarily because that is the number one active threat to people's lives right now. For some people it is. So I want to be careful with my words here, but I definitely, as it's my own political belief that it's these structural issues that are far more pressing than access to bathrooms. Although accessing bathrooms can become a life or death situation for people in the state of Florida. But as, you know, Rebecca was just highlighting, heat waves and the rising intensity of heat waves is a much greater threat to people who are, for instance, wearing binders, who are taking medications that impact, you know, their sensitivity to heat. There are all these different ways that climate change actually really impacts trans bodies. But one of the important reasons for looking at this legislation right now that is because it's also separating people from each other. It's creating these kinds of niche issues that different communities are then fighting in these really siloed ways. And so, for instance, attacking the ability for trans kids to be able to be called by their names and their pronouns in schools, like, yes, it has a massive amount of impact on that individual's life as they're moving through school. But it also creates this climate in which people are just are scared. And people are scared. People are having a harder time, I think, organizing together towards some things that can improve everyone's lives. Like, for instance, I think about all these attacks on trans healthcare. And instead of like thinking about, well, how do we, you know, put out each of these fires, each of these different forms of legislative violence and like, you know, fighting defensively? Well, you know, we really need universal healthcare that includes comprehensive medical coverage for all people. And for, as Valencia Gunder says at one point, like healthcare for whatever a human wants to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And that includes trans people and helps to create a bridge between trans issues and the kinds of things that all human beings need in these times. So saying that, it's always important to me to think about the how to tell a story that's about building bridges and not wedges, right? So that said, I did want to bring up and include that really powerful quote from Tara in Tallahassee, calling this current legislative session a transgenocide. I think because, I mean, it highlights the fact that the way that the legislation is worded seeks to eliminate trans people from society, both like as in, you know, as people unable to access healthcare, right? There's like literal death, but then also just the ability for people to imagine themselves and to be present and visible in the world. So culturally as well. I think that the other thing that's really important to bring up about Tara's story here and the way that they're using that term of transgenocide is it's really looking at state violence, not just in terms of the legislation, but also in terms of the militarization of the police. I agree that the state overall does not have a plan for dealing with climate change when it's talking in the media, but they definitely are aware of climate change and planning for it when it comes to the funding of the police and the increased militarization of the police. And that is their climate change plan right now. And so highlighting the trans genocide, I think, is also that terminology. Yes, it provokes a lot of fear. And I want to preserve that person's words and their meanings for that words, which was really to highlight the militarization of the police and the kinds of violence that enables them to carry out.
Wow, that's a great point. Barbara, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted to build off of what Vanessa had said about trans people being erased and kind of my understanding also of a trans genocide. And this has to do with an experience that I had with an environmental organization in South Florida. So I had previously spoken to Yarrow, another director on the film, about this. So there are very few organizations in South Florida that focus on environmental justice. A lot of them kind of focus more on being green, recycling, things like that, things that we can do to lower emissions. So things that might be done to prevent or slow down climate change. But as many scientists have discussed, it might be too late for parts of Florida already, especially South Florida, for example. And we now have to start talking about interventions and things that we can do to start addressing vulnerable groups of people as we are seeing these effects of sea level rise, storms, etc. And one of the groups that tends to get left out in particular are trans people. And I think that the hate that the government is directing, the Florida government is directing against trans people, is contributing to this a lot, and how they're being ignored and erased and not supported by not just environmental groups, but even groups that focus on environmental justice. So for example, I tried to work with an organization that focused on environmental justice and in particular emphasize racial justice in terms of, you know, the environment and the links with the environment. And I thought that this organization was so important and so great, and it really is. I still think that because there's very little discussion about this in South Florida, very little explicit discussion about these issues. But at the same time, that organization did ignore dimensions of heterosexism and of transphobia. And for example, didn't want to share the documentary with folks in the organization because they felt that it might be too politicized because of what they said was the trans issue in Florida. Yeah. So I think that is a very practical example of how trans people and trans experiences get erased. And because of that, this marginalized group is not getting the support that they need in order to, you know, just like live through this really difficult time.
Mm-hmm. I think what you said is so critical. I think there's a battle inside the environmental movement between the people who want to think a lot about recycling and these green companies and distance themselves from anything to do with environmental justice, when environmental justice is the elephant in the room. And so your film really hits that on the head, I feel. And I wonder if there's a way to, like, this is just a follow-up question. I wonder if there's a way to use your film to continually critique the national organizations and to maybe think about that, because I just think you could be in a really important position to critique all of the national environmental organizations who are ignoring the disproportionate effects on the communities you highlight.
Yeah. Did anybody wanted to answer that? Go ahead, Vanessa.
Yeah, I'll say that, we focused really, we worked really hard to make sure that this was a Florida story and Florida as a construct, right? Also, Florida's as situated in the South. So it's also a Southern story. But as we're like taking it to other places, we do hear a lot of people sharing that this resonates with them in different ways. Like I went to a screening of this in Houston, Texas, and folks there were saying like, you could basically take the same plot and lay it over the particularities of what we're dealing with here. And I think that that's more of how I would like to move, is to be thinking about those particularities, helping people figure those out in their own places, in their own lands. I'm not going to pretend to be a person that knows much about national level legislation or policy worlds. I really encourage people who are in those worlds to watch the film and to think with some folks who are also doing very different hyper-local kinds of strategies, because the kinds of disasters we experience are experienced on a hyper-local level. And so being able to uplift that level of organizing and encourage people to form their mutual aid pods, form their families of care. And, you know, I think people who have already invested deeply in the policy world, there is a lane for you there. I'm not going to pretend to know it, but I want to encourage those conversations and to lift up solutions that are happening at very different scales that don't just center what's happening on the national level.
For people who haven't seen the film, it is also still very uplifting, I thought, because it shows how much activism is going on. And I really appreciate how you guys want to create an alternative world, and you actually do that. You're not like just talking about it. You have people involved in mutual aid. You do these queer swamp tours. You have people living on rural land, creating community, have community gardens, as well as including indigenous visions of land. And the use of art is very important in this concept of creating a vision of a different world, but also about creating hope. And can you talk a little bit about some of the specific ways that you're enacting how we can live? And we don't have much time, so if Barbara or Rebecca, you haven't spoken, would you like to talk a little bit about, I know you did the queer swamp tours, but a little bit about this idea of creating alternative spaces and visions, and how art maybe is important in that too, or humor and all these other things.
And you also had music, the songs.
Oh, and music. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Sure, I can talk a little bit. I think that the film does show a lot of examples of how some folks in Florida are actively taking steps to create the worlds we want to see, to bring joy and beauty and hope into our lives, and to protect ourselves from the climate disasters that are already happening. I think that it's happening because it has to happen. Like, we're doing that because we have to do that. I think that it's clear to me at this point. I think it's clear to a whole lot of people that we can't rely on the governments, state or federal or local, to make the shifts that we need to see to keep each other alive, whether we mean trans community, queer community, migrant community, immigrant community, Black community. We cannot rely on the people in power to make the changes, the systemic changes that need to happen in order to keep each other safe. And so we have to find ways to do it ourselves. So I think the things that you're seeing in the film are like an answer to that. It's not necessarily like, oh, what type of world do we want to see? And let's create that. It's more like, if we want to survive in this world, we need to do it together. We can't do it alone. Nobody can do it alone. We need to do it together. And we have to do it now. Like, we can't wait for somebody else to do it. So it's like coming out of a need. It's not necessarily like a vision that to be created. It's like, mm-hmm. We need to survive. How are we going to do it? And then these are some of the ways that we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. And some of those ways include creating space for joy and hope, right? Because we are up against a lot. It can be really depressing to exist in this world every single day on so many levels. Definitely as a queer trans person in the entire South, as Vanessa said, definitely not just Florida. It can be really hard and depressing, especially during legislative seasons. In terms of climate change and climate impact, it can be really depressing in terms of, yeah, just genocides that are happening throughout the world, in terms of all these things that are have been happening in an ongoing way that we don't see change. Like, we don't see a lot of change, and it can be really, really, really depressing and really hard to see a path forward. And I think the only way we can see a path forward is if we, yeah, know that we're not alone. We like actively create spaces for joy, because we have to live a balanced life. We just can't do it if we don't do that. So I think, yeah, things we have to do to survive. We have to take care of each other. We have to experience joy together.
So Barbara, did you want to say anything, or do you want to pass it to Vanessa?
I'll pass it to Vanessa.
Go for it, Vanessa.
Well, I'll just jump off from what Rebecca was saying about joy. And I want to particularly shout out our co-director, Shug McDaniel, for continuously pushing us as a team to lean into joy, joy, joy. You know, the beach scene was their idea. It's this scene that you see kind of moving through the film. And to me, it really celebrates these like everyday acts of resistance just through living joyously. That joy is not separate from this devastation. They coexist. And to make sure that there's always space for that, because otherwise we just imagine, you know, it's so easy to imagine just like the end of the world, and like the end of the world is coming, and it's just bleak. It's a slow slide towards the unraveling of what we knew, and the reweaving of what can become. There's this quote from James Baldwin that I saw recently over Pride Month, where he says, you know, "I cannot afford despair. You can't tell the children that there is no hope." And I love that. And I think that's very important with climate change stories right now. You know, think about the wild success of films like Don't Look Up, with its nihilistic fatalism, like the end of the world is inevitable there, right? So I don't think we need another story telling us that there's nothing we can do. And at the same time, you know, we can't pretend that there are easy solutions. Like, think of the laundry list of individual actions you could take at the end of an inconvenient truth. And like, the inconvenient truth is none of those things are solutions. The goal of the solutions we need is not to maintain the status quo of modern Western life. So we need stories that make transformation irresistible, that like, as the things that we've learned to rely upon fail around us, that we are powerful, creative forces that can shape change and create new systems. That's what I love about queer ecologies. As Barbara was saying back at the beginning of this conversation, you know, colonialism required immense social control, right? The diversity of sexuality, gender, and kinship systems among Indigenous people was used as justification for colonialism. This planet that we're on is so exuberantly diverse. Colonial capitalism just paves over all of that in pursuit of monoculture, monocultures of the land and monocultures of the mind. And so this story is trying to just like ask people to get out of that, just like lean into imagining something different. So it's a story about the inevitability of change and the power of creative communities to shape that change. The stories, the interviewees, especially the artists, we really leaned into talking to artists to insist that we must dream bigger. We must engage our creative imaginations at the same time that we root and embed more deeply in the literal earth that we are. Mm. And so, you know, it's these ecological networks that can be a source of creative power. So I think that I'm so glad that stood out to you, that it's not just about critique. It's about creation.
Mm-hmm. That's so important.
Thank you. That's a great sum up. Yeah. What they said is exemplary about the role of music and art as a tool for creating joy. And you said talking to the artists and having the singer on the couch. That was amazing. Yeah.
One more thing I'll say about that, because we mentioned lots of things DeSantis has done. He's also just led the largest cuts to arts funding in Florida's history.
I saw that and I made a poster already about it.
So I think that it speaks volumes to not just the problem here, but
he connects the dots too. So that's what we all have to know. Yeah.
Right. Santos just cut $30 million. He cut all the arts funding. So yes, that's very important what you said, Kim. He connects the dots. The right connects the dots. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Well, when we connect the dots, we can make a picture that's a lot better. So let's do the dot connecting.
Absolutely.
Move them all around.
Absolutely.
And who's better to create differences and joy than queer community, especially the queers of color and the trans community? So I think that really also comes out in the film. The queer joy is something straight cis heteronormative culture does not have.
And Black joy. I really love that you showed the Freedom Lab and the essential Black joy. That's another important thing.
Will those be cut, you think, places like that? Because I don't know how many of them get arts funding, but the Freedom Lab and all these other places, are they going to relying on funding from the state?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. Like, the arts funding is also cultural funding. So it's not just explicitly arts. It does like extend in a variety of ways. Freedom Lab gets funding from a lot of different sources. So,
okay.
But funding is an ongoing problem always.
Is there anybody have anything they wanted to say that they didn't get included?
I have one last closing word, which is just, you know, the things that we've talked about here are just some of the stories that get woven through the film. I really encourage people to check out our website and see synopses of the 14 amazing different people in the film and get connected to the work that they're currently doing. Like I said, the goal of this film is to be an organizing tool. So we're putting it into your hands now. What are you going to do with it? So please, like, we're sharing it right now over the month of July. Watch, engage your community. And remember, Pride Month is the beginning of hurricane season.
Yeah.
Get your community together. Maybe this film can be part of that and starting to figure out what you're going to do to keep each other safe and to shape the futures that we all want to live in together.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was an interview with Vanessa Raddatz, Barbara Perez, and Rebecca Wood, queer activists talking about the film Can't Stop Change, Queer Climate Stories from the Florida Frontlines, which is now available to see online for the month of July at kinema.com, which is spelled K-I-N-E-M-A. I cannot recommend this film highly enough. It is inspiring to see so many queer activists organizing and creating community in the homophobic, racist, sexist state of Florida. You can also go to the film's website at queerecoproject.org.
Put out the fire. Put out the fire. Put out the fire. Our house is on fire.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated dedicated journalists, because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK, and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org.